This is a Pinball News production.
Good afternoon, everybody. Today, I'll probably try to give you an approximately 20-minute presentation that will cover my almost 20 years in pinball. Prior to my actually working in the industry, my affection for the game wasn't even close to what it would later become. It was very casual. I would enjoy whatever game I came upon in a local restaurant or bowling alley. In my youth, I actually played more bingo-style machines than anything else. Flipper machines were around, but they weren't as popular because they didn't pay off as well as the bingos. Although it wasn't legal, being typical teenagers, we were all about the money, and so we put our 10 cents or 20 cents or whatever it happened to be and maybe walked out with $50 at a time. Back in 1967, being 19 years of age, we all got to spend some time working for Uncle Sam. I spent some of my time on the northernmost point of the islands of Japan in a little fishing village called Wakanai. Believe it or not. That's the guy that was 19. Or no, he's 21 there. Here's where I was started running into many more traditional flipper machines, all still electromechanical, of course. I was discharged from the Air Force in 71 and now I had to go to work for a living. I started out in the printing business, running an offset press, something I had learned in high school. After some years of doing that, I decided I had enough of working for a living and decided to try something new. Anything. Even if it involved a pay cut. And it did. In 1979, I answered an ad in the newspaper for a game tester troubleshooter for a little company in Addison, Illinois called Gameplan. I was hired on as a game tester, and they were manufacturing their cocktail pin, Star Trip, at this time. Which, that's not Star Trip, but that's okay. So, that's Camel Light, I believe, but they were just doing that, too. They all looked pretty much the same. they were fun enough. You know, I cut my pinball teeth on these, you know, troubleshooting them. Go ahead, what's next? I don't even know. There's the Star Trip. And it was, you know, they're not that big of a game, so the game rules themselves weren't very deep, and although they were electronic in the displays, the rules hadn't gone past the electromechanical stage yet. But I did have a lot of fun learning what makes a solid state pin game tick, and as the years passed by, I made a lot of good friends too. The company now started making full size games, with Sharpshooter being their lead game. And it was very well received by the pinball community, and it kept them making more games. One day we were discussing the art on the game, and I mentioned that I dabbled in that type of artwork too, as a hobby. So I brought in some of my work, mostly poster-sized renditions of old comic book covers that I had done, for my friends to take a look at. I guess one of them went to get some of the engineers up to the factory to have a look too, and they liked what they saw because they offered me a job doing the artwork for their new wide-body pinball, which is going to be called Global Warfare. Yeah, this is the final sketch of before it went to color separations. And someone somewhere was nice enough to go to IPDB and post this on it because I haven't seen this game in many, many years. They only made 10 of them. They never got past the samples. It is a wide-body, not a full-wide, but a 2x4, as we used to call them. Same size that Rocky and Spirit were. And the head man in engineering there that brought me in was Ed Cibula, who had been in the pinball industry for quite some time, mostly with Chicago Coin, and also spent his later years at Data East, Sega, and Stern. While I was doing my artwork, I continued to give feedback to Ed on the games in production, submit ideas for problems and for problem cures, and new layouts for pinball games. I was really beginning to like this job a lot. Mr. Cibula again liked what I did on my own and offered me another position as an apprentice pinball game designer under his tutelage. Now, this was way cool. I finished my art package for Global Warfare and proceeded to help out in any way I could in engineering and development of their next pinball machine. There we go. I finished helped finish up Pinball Lizard, which you see once in a while. It was a pretty good game. I was getting my hands actually on a whitewood for the first time. And I had no experience prior to that. I never thought I would ever get anything past that, but I was then given the opportunity to lay out my own design. I never thought it would see the light of day, but one never really knows. I also decided to take a crack at a cocktail pin layout, but a hiccup was now thrown into the pin business at Game Plan. They had diversified into slot machines and licensed video games, too. The pinball market for them was closing up, and the video was just starting to boom. And Game Plan decided to stop the production of pinballs at this time, and I was just getting on a roll. What a wet blanket announcement that was. I was assured of my continued employment, and I did some artwork for the video cabinets and slot machine glasses, but the bug had already bitten me. I really like this pinball machine design. I happened to spot an ad in a trade publication. I can't recall if it was Replay or Playmeter for a pin game designer. They were actually looking for one at D. Gottlieb & Company. So, well, I seized the opportunity, grabbed my portfolio of designs I had made, and went over and talked to Gil Pollack. He was the vice president at that time over there. And we had a very good meeting, and Gil informed me that they had just filled the position. But he liked what I showed him, and he says they are going to make two people new game designers instead of just one. So I was very, very, very fortunate at that time. I said my farewells to the staff at Game Plan and prepared for my new adventures at Gottlieb. As you can see, this is the whitewood for Rocky, and there's an extra jet bumper in the middle, which we decided to pull out at the last minute, and it cleared a way to return the ball back to the top of the playfield. Made it a lot better flowing game. But that was actually my second game. The first game that I laid out as a whitewood just didn't make it. So everyone has their failures, too. And that was a good one. And I learned what was good for the game didn't necessarily have to be so much different. It was the layout that really mattered, the rules, not so much a gimmick or a toy. There's a Rocky out there you guys can go kick or whatever. Well, we make machines now, that, you know, so you can kick them. You look at those the wood rails; they're kind of fragile. I'm wondering why they even lasted this long. No, that's okay. We can go on to my next game was Spirit, and this is the whitewood for that. You also notice there's no display in the middle for the bonus. That was a last minute add-on feature. They said, "Hey, we got the cable, we got the displays. Let's use them up." And basically, well, there was a six-digit display, and we had changed to seven. And we had a whole big inventory of six-digit displays, so boom, they threw a bonus in the middle there. After Spirit, I've just got the brochures here. Go ahead. That was followed by Striker, which this is the first time I've seen one in about 25 years here. They almost all went to Europe. Nobody made soccer games at that time, but... And I didn't either, really. I take credit only because I did lay the layout for this. This was supposed to be a science fiction machine, and they said, "Oh, we have too much science fiction. How about a soccer game?" And I said, "Ah, yuck." So there was one fellow that did like soccer at the time, and he was the programmer, Alan Edwall, and I said, "Okay, yeah, he can do it." And I just literally handed it to him, and he finished it. He placed the inserts and made the game rules. And then came Qbert's Quest. This was another request from management. Let's go. We have got this successful video game. What can we do? What can we do? Let's make homage to it and make a pinball machine out of it. So this is my attempt to imitate the video game rules, literally, with the coily and I don't remember the other UGG and the other bad guys coming down to attack you and steal things from you. And you had to shoot back and try to defeat them. And the layout was just really strange. But it was moderately successful, especially after the successful video game. And it's a very unusual layout. Yeah, these shots are the actual photos that they took for the brochures. I ended up with the transparencies. I had to hold these up against a lit window to get a picture of them. And then came Crawl. This was one of the assignments again from management. They made a deal with Columbia Pictures, who had purchased Gottlieb by this point, and they wanted to get their new hot movie in on the pinball machine. Well, we didn't know what it was going to turn out like, but you never know. So we had two people doing versions of Krull. I did this one, and Ed Krinsky did one that was really, really interesting. He made a game that was entirely transparent. Did the not the sides, though, not like the one you see here. He did the play field in clear acrylic and at a lower level, which was really dramatic. But it was very expensive also, and much more unconventional than this to build. So the learning curve on this would have been a lot smaller, so that's, I believe, why they ended up taking my design. And I used a Fresnel lens, or Fresnel lens, whatever way you want to pronounce that, to see the lower level. Okay, and then this is the finished artwork, three-level game. And these were taken by the director of art at the time, Rich Tracy, and never thought about not making a brochure, but go ahead. These are the only pictures we have of the engineering samples. It turned out that it was nice to do. This is a transparency of the original artwork. I ended up with this, too. And I really don't know why. It was like nobody else to give them to, I guess. Here, you take them. And I said, okay, I did. And it was back then. It was, you know, thank you. Okay, run. Put them in the box. And that's but a lot of this stuff just ended up thrown in the box. Didn't destroy it, but there was no appreciation for it at the time. This is a little mystery for me. I don't know if anybody, I've been searching for years for the artist. I don't know who did this artwork. If it was just a hired gun that they put on for this one project, I've asked every artist that I've ever run across if they did it, and they all disclaim it. It's a nice looking game. Nice looking painting. I do know that he or she was working fairly slowly on it, and they said, that's it, time's up. So the center area of the back glass is nice and sharp. It's finished painting, but the side vignettes are pretty rough still, if you take a look at them. You ever get to see a picture of it sometime. And then came Milestar. Oof. A funny thing happened. Coca-Cola purchased Columbia Pictures, and D. Gottlieb & Company was a wholly owned subsidiary of Columbia. And the powers that be at Coca-Cola decided they wanted to try and run things their way at the little game company they had just acquired. First on the list was to change the name to something they felt was much more dynamic, in keeping with the video times. Out with the old, in with the new. What they came up with was called Milestar. Or as my colleague and friend Ed Krinsky pointed out to everyone at the engineering announcement meeting, Milestar, spelled backwards, is pronounced rat slime. This unexpected feedback probably wasn't received very well, and the pinball side of engineering quickly turned into the redheaded stepchild. We were tolerated only because we were the only thing keeping the people working in the plant. They couldn't produce a successful video game. I'm sure it hurt. Shutting down pinball seemed to be one of their goals. Now, one great game did come out of the video department, Qbert, but it was done before the company renaming, and they didn't smell that success again. Unless you want to count Mach 3, which was a Laserdisc game. It was a one-hit wonder that ended up pretty badly because all the Laserdiscs failed in the field. As a side note to this period at the time, my dead game plan layout came back to life unexpectedly. Go ahead. And it turned up at a AMOA show as Attila the Hun. And I had no idea it was going to be produced. And was very shocked to see it there. And they changed it a little bit, but, you know, it's their game. And it was a nice surprise for me to see it there. Okay, then being under the Milestar yoke, I was able to sneak in a couple of games. This was among of a bunch of revisiting of old successful Gottlieb games and making them electronic. They were all designed by Ed Krinsky, and he had the honor of redoing his old games. He wasn't real happy about it, but everybody still had a job. But I was able to sneak in this one. This is called The Games. It's the white wood from that. And the other one that was done when I think Los Angeles hosted the Summer Olympics. And the other one was Alien Star. And there's very little bit, the center area was an attempt. We experimented with doing an infinity light, you know, with the mirrors and the double pane mirrors and the lights going around spinning, but it didn't work. So we just pulled it out. Something that was very, fairly cheap at the time, you know, to put in, but if it had worked, it would have been there, but it didn't. But we got to do two ball, multi ball. Woo. Were we happy? And that was the attempt at the infinity light. And that's just about how it looked. Bad. Pretty bad. And then came Premiere. But they shut down MileStar pretty suddenly. And everybody was just kind of like, oh, we're going to be out on the street again. Well, Gil Pollack and the main distributor for Gottlieb, Mondial, got together and decided to keep the pinball machines going. Only the pinball, not the video. So they struck a deal. I was out of work maybe only 2 weeks, and that's how fast they got it done. And we moved all the assets from the plant in Northlake to another smaller facility in Bensonville, which is about 20 miles away. And redid everything. Just totally rebuilt it from scratch. This is John Beers. This, you can see our wonderful technology here, too. Go ahead. Check those computers out, huh? 6502 technology. This is Touchdown. This is the first game that actually got into production at Premiere. The samples were run at MileStar. But that's when the roof caved in and everything was pretty much done. And again, you can see the austerity on the games. There's just, don't spend no money. And that was our first show. That's John Beers. The one to the left of him is El Dorado. It's an Ed Krinsky game. You recognize the layout on it. It's the same as Canada Dry or Alpha City, I think it was. And there's an El Dorado here, too. Yeah, Target Alpha, that's what it was. And new artwork, and it's solid state, of course. So that was the one that was in production at MileStar at the time, and we continued to finish the production, and then went into the production on Touchdown. And this was so bad, we had a one-sided brochure. they didn't even bother printing the other side. And after that, I did Ice Fever. Thank you. Go ahead. The white wood. Oh, I did a night shot on that one, too. Okay, go ahead. And we did a little animation in the back glass, too. That was kind of cute. Something a little extra. We're still not spending a lot of money, but we're in business. This one was one of a labor of love for me, being a Cub fan. Chicago Cubs triple play. We even sold the back glasses separately. Anything to make a buck. Framed, too. And this is the production line during the triple play run. That's how they did things at Premiere. These games are pretty much finished and get... Oh, there's that guy again. Then we did Tag Team Pinball. Tag Team Pinball was kind of cool. This was an attempt to do something a little different with the rules, where you actually could join up the first and third player and team up and play against the second and fourth. This is an interesting shot. You notice the little inset of the game there. That's there on purpose. The gentleman on the left underwear was too revealing, to say the least. Okay, so let's do something to cover it up. Okay, and that's the way that ended up that way. Go ahead. Then came Rock. This brings up the funny story with Steve Ritchie. He called me from Williams, and I said, why is Steve calling me? And, we knew each other by reputation. We met each other at shows. So I got on the phone with him. He says, how dare you? You put a game into production with no jet bumpers. And I go, oh, okay. That was it. That's why he called. He just wanted to chastise me about no jet bumpers. But he said the game was fun. It was great. And it doesn't have any. This was our first show back with original stuff from Premiere and not anything left over. Look at the hair, huh? Gorgeous. Nice hair. This is my homage to one of my favorite games, Firepower. I did Raven with the layout, pretty much with the jet bumpers in approximately the same area and the targets in front of them. And Steve knows it, and I told him many times, it's my favorite game by him. And it came out pretty good. This was a lot of fun to play, for me anyhow. There again, we're not spending a lot of money. This young lady was our model. We couldn't find a decent model that had any musculature on them. All the models were skinny little rails, pretty faces, but that's about it. This lady was an aerobics instructor, and she was a girlfriend of one of the guys that was in sales, and she accepted the job. I said, it's great, that's her. So she became Raven, just kind of automatically overnight. Raven was the code name Rambo used in the movie. That was his code name, so that's why we used the name Raven. The helicopter in the background is a crop duster. Yeah, everybody likes that. And there's a couple of shots on the set there. Go ahead. Next one up was Hollywood Heat. That was a lot of fun. This is another trivia. No, you can blow this one up too, Ron. Nice car that was rolled off the trailer, literally, and rolled back on the trailer. Nobody started it up. Well, we got the pictures taken of it. Found some models, especially the fellow that looks a lot like Don Johnson. The sky is, of course, fake. If you'll notice, the Carlisle Hotel where it was shot on Ocean Boulevard in Miami. Three nice fluorescent lamps coming down the front of the Art Deco building. It's a gorgeous building. Look at the reflection on the car. Two. Yeah, the other one was faked, and it was out at the time of the photo. And nobody caught the reflection. Yeah, things, trivia things. You know, you live long enough, you figure out all this stuff. Go ahead. And most of the models, like the fellow there, that was, Jeff Walker, he was our sales guy, and he looked good in baggy pants. Next was came Genesis, one of my favorites. I enjoyed doing that one. We had this little surprise robot revelation. You're trying to create the robot, collect the body parts in the play field. And what happened is these games went on out on locations, especially in the bars. There was a half a can, literally, that just rolled over and revealed this little statuette of a robot. Big thrills. And then it'll come back and cover it up. That was the carrot to shoot for. Well, people were swapping out the robot for pictures. And sometimes they were not so nice. And you never knew what you were going to get, and that was kind of... It was a big thing when that came out. And the bar locations loved the game. They just kept swapping things in and out and go, oh, my God, what is that? And that was kind of funny. But it was a fairly successful game for us. And then we came to our next adventure into let's use another movie theme without paying for it. This was called Gold Wings. I don't know who the guy was. And the brochure is kind of nice. And Monte Carlo was a very successful game for us. This, as a bit of trivia, the gentleman in the background from left to right is Alvin Gottlieb. Jim Roberts was an owner of a major monitor company, and Gil Pollack and some young lady from the Gaslight Club, where this was shot. And there was a lot of bells in this one. We had we had four separate drop target banks, the roulette wheel. Three jet bumpers, the header with all the lights on it. And while we were doing this, we were becoming very successful and trying to branch out into other things. And board manufacture is something we also did, but I don't think anybody ever bid on it. And the that was the end of that venture. The photo on the top is the building that was Premier Technology in Bensenville, Illinois. The photo on the bottom is a small facility in Fargo, North Dakota, where all the cables were made. And I don't know why. I guess that's just the way they were doing it at the time, why they had it up there. Something else that was inherited from the old days, I guess. This is spring break, which was a first game we did without a plunger. It was just an electric shooter game. And this was TX Sector, which is a shell game of sorts, where you would shoot a ball in, and the first person in it got on this game when it was brand new and turned it on. The first ball got eaten, and it disappeared, and you never saw it again until you broke the game down and took the ball out where it is. And so that was the shell game. You shoot it up in one end, and you do this little light show and sound show, and the ball would kick out the other side. There was no actual transportation of the ball. There was no subway or anything. The ball just stayed there, and the one that was hidden kicked out. So then when you had to do the transportation again, you had to shoot it back on this side, and it just went back the other way, and they exchanged back and forth. Simple gimmick. The artwork was very unusual. It was almost like an overdriven video. This was the only brochure we did that was not an 8.5 by 11 brochure. The only place you could get this brochure was in a replay or play meter. It was tipped in specially. This brochure was about this big. And that's why you see the creases in it, because there weren't any flat. I don't even remember if we did any posters or anything with this thing, but it could have been. And then I did a two-level game. This is called Victory. Originally, it was a three-level game, as you can see here. But we brought in the big guns and said, oh, that's too expensive. Let's get rid of that. So we did. I also tried to put a little miniature racetrack down there rather than a full-fledged play field, and just have a little car just drive around on a track. And I found out at the end of the day that it was just as expensive as putting a play field in there. So we dropped them both. This is a four-page brochure, and I never understood why either. Yeah. That game was pretty well received. We did pretty good with that. Then came the single-level games. I was able to finish up this one for them. This was the first one to let it off. This was very well received. A lot of people bought this one, this game. It just a Silver Slugger, of course. It had some animation in the back glass with lights, but they were cute. I'd like to have one of these things. Another job we got was to revisit old games. So I got to revisit Sinbad on this occasion, and it turned into Robo War, trying to use the same idea of the playfield and update it, put a ramp in it, put something else in it. So we did this for Sinbad and another Ed Kritsky. Well, here's the Sinbad game. And another one called Excalibur, which they were just okay. And there was also an Ed Krinsky game, the original one called Countdown. And the last game I left with them was the Whitewood for this, Deadly Weapon. I saw it when it was finished. I wasn't real happy what they did. They changed it, but it's still, to my credit or discredit, at that point I and Premier had a parting of the ways, and I decided it was best for both of us if I just finished my contract, which was up at that time, and leave. Then I went to Williams and talked to Steve Kordick and Ken Fidesna, Steve was in charge of engineering, and Ken was the vice president, and had lunch with them, and they said, sure, he'd come work for us. So I did. And one of my first assignments was to get Bugs Bunny running. And this was an idea I brought in. And I got a lot of pictures of this one. And finish up the Bride of Pinbot, which was just a really bare-bones Whitewood. It wasn't finished. The playfield wasn't even finished. This was also... My co-designer on this is Python Angelo, who's an artist and a very fine artist. But he's not a mechanical guy, so a lot of the the fine stuff that he did, couldn't do, I did on this game. And so we own co-design rights, I believe, on this, I guess you could call it. He had the idea for the head, the spinning the head around and giving her different expressions and bringing the robot to life. And the rest of the flow of the machine, the play field, was pretty much mine, the crisscross ramp, the upper levels, black rose. Pat McMahon was our artist on this. And they had a catapult mechanism that was used in big guns, I believe. And I decided to try and take that mechanism, throw it underneath the playfield, and oscillate it, and make that my cannon. And that's the way the cannon mechanism came about. And if you look closely on the right side there, there's a fellow with his arm that's kind of like this. And you can see a lightning bolt on it, and I got a knife in my teeth. And it was me. The fellow next to me was Greg Ferris. He's the art director. There's a fellow over here in a green watch cap. I can't see him from here. But he's the artist, Pat McMahon. And everybody got on this one, pretty much. Yeah, I mean, a bunch of pirates, why not? Go ahead. And it came Creature. We had such a good time doing this game. We had to stop ourselves. We got on a roll for the program, especially on things like Move Your Car, where we just said, oh, let's do this, let's do that. And it worked, but then we ran out of memory, ran out of time, and this is what came out of it. And still a good game. One of my favorites. Of course, I'm sure everybody knows the story about the guy in the pith helmet. It was an aged photograph of my son, because we couldn't use the actor's likenesses. So I said, put my kid on there. So that's what happens. And we were doing a little jump ball. Me and Jim Shelver came in for the presentation of the game, I guess. The model on the right side is the actual model that was used in the holographic filming, or I guess exposure. It had to be done all in shades of gray. And they had a couple of extra statues made. I painted one up, and that's the guy in green. And the other guy, that strange dude again. Go ahead. And we had a little bit of extra plastic on the plastic set, so I did this with it. Instead of being conservative and cutting the plastic in half, I said, let's use it. And we had such nice success. I went and got these patches made for the design team. Now, I was trying to get some jackets, but never came to fruition. I did have some sweatshirts made, and I think everybody got one. And we did Judge Dredd, one of my favorites. I loved comic books, and this is a British comic book. I was also given the opportunity to use Stallone's movie likeness, and I said, no, let's just keep it with the comic book. Let's try to do something true to its roots. And although Stallone was respectable in the role, I'm glad we didn't do it. This turned out to be a lot better, I think. And everyone knows the story of the planet and the ball locking mechanism, which is now available as a kit the way it was really designed. They just were afraid the ball was going to get stuck in there, so they said, no, we can't do that. The one here does have the kit in it, and it looks and plays really, really nice. Kevin O'Connor's artwork is just sensational. He started with me with Creature, and from then on, we stuck together. We made a good team. So he did Judge Dredd for me, another little cut of plastic. And we did Flintstones together. That was nice. We got a trip to Hollywood out of this to go see the Flintstones set. I think I got a couple in here. Oh, this is the original, what they call an armature of the sculpture for the bottom arch, because I made it out of plastic instead of the traditional form of metal. And I had to put a metal handle under it, of course, so you could really grab it. And these were the side buildings, the residential area, and that was the shop area, and this is the residential area. And here we are, actually in the set. It was done in a quarry. They made the set in a quarry. The fellow that owns the quarry, he actually owned two quarries, and one was across the road on the other side, and he would work one year and the other one the next year. And so the one that wasn't being used, they built Bedrock in. And we were there just before they were ready to demolish it. Oh, that's Kevin O'Connor. And the other fellow there was Jeff Johnson. He was the programmer. He programmed Creature also. And Judge Dredd and Flintstones. And then I came to Congo. This is another little ditty that nobody wanted to do in engineering. It was one of those things that, come on, we got the license, let's use it. And I was next up. I always seem to be next up. But we had fun with this. We also got another plane ride out to here to California and went to the set, met Stan Winston, Academy Award-winning special effects fella, and he put on a nice show with all the gorillas half in costume, but they weren't finished yet, but they had their arm extensions on and showed us how to do this. And it was overall a real nice presentation. The gray gorilla in the lower play field was not coming out right. And we sent the whole thing in to Stan Winston. He re-sculpted it free. He says, just get it to look right. So that's an actual sculpture by Stan Winston. And I got to hurry up. I'm running out of time. Sorry. It just seems to last so long. This is the Flintstones, just as a side note. It was originally supposed to be a wide body. This is all that's really left of it. I had a nest on the top that this bird would pick up the ball and circle around the play field and drop it into different holes. Yeah. And he would circle around and drop it in volcano holes for points, but we never built it. And ACES was never built. It was just one thing that's where now it's like, oh, this is the only thing that was artwork was done for. And this is the actual layout, which somebody owns the rights to, by the way. And I got Kevin to do a little homage for all the stuff we did together. And I think I'm just about out of time, huh? Two still. This was the Beatles game that I wanted to do, and I couldn't get them to sign off on the license. I had a separate upper-level play field that when we turned the main play field dark, it would reflect down off the top glass, and you'd have a look like another play field that was farther down in the cabinet. And the glass actually acted as the play field. The ball would ride in it, and it was sandwiched close enough so all the switches would still actuate. And that was the upper play field. Not much, but... Okay, I did some work for a company called ICE. They said they wanted to get into pinball machines. And by then, I had learned this 3D engineering CAD called SolidWorks. And I did the whole game in CAD for them. And then they decided not to build it. This was going to be Caddyshack. They had the license all lined up. Bill Murray was all on board and everything. This would have been fun. Then I did a quickie for Fox Sports and also presented them with this. They wanted a promo for their 2004 All-Star game that was in Detroit. And they wanted a real game designer to do the game. Can you run the video now, Ron? And this is I sent them a solid file of that game, and then they ran and did the... Anyhow, that was going to be the the actual ad that they did for the All-Star game. And after that, it was pretty much not much going on for me. I work as a contract engineer. I keep my hands into things by doing shows like this. I enjoy doing it. I love meeting people. And I was supposed to have time enough in my mind for a Q&A, but I guess we ran out. But if you got any questions, I'll be over at the Pin Game Journal booth probably. And if we got one or two, maybe I can field them here. Yes?
How do you come up with the angles on some of the layout so that it's likely that the ball will hit from the river
again. Trial and error. Seriously, yeah. There are sweet spots that when you're down at the bottom of the game, you know that sweet spot. Well, you take the angle of that flipper and you just move it like this to the side of the game. That's still the sweet spot for that flipper.
So are you guys actually prototyping it and then just throwing a ball at it to see where it's going to...
Sometimes, yeah, sometimes. But just as a place to start, that's what you would do. You'd take the same flipper angle and translate it to what it would be up on top, and then take the sweet spot and make those your shots. Anybody else? I guess I I satisfied everyone's curiosity. Good. Thanks, everybody.